Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. Today, we see vegetables with new eyes, the eyes of the expert's expert. She's Elizabeth Schneider, a woman who's given over the past decade to sleuthing every shred of information on produce. Elizabeth can tell you the best varieties to buy and the best ways to cook them. Her book is aptly named. It's called The Essential Reference, Vegetables from Amaranth to Zucchini. That evangelist of the cheese counter, Steve Jenkins, wants to convert us to grown-up goat cheeses. Bonnie Doon Vineyard's Randall Graham, a wine maverick if there ever was one, forecasts a revolution in bottling. We go to Mexico with Chef Susanna Trilling. She's taking us into the kitchen with the woman who taught her to cook mole. Then it's mind games in restaurants. A psychology prof has discovered what can make us tip more. Some great tricks for waiters. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Okay, Jane and Michael Stern are stepping up to the mic. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine.
Hi, Lynn. We just got back from Tucson, where we found a great place to eat called Marisco's Chihuahua.
Oh, what's it like?
It's a seafood place, as the name suggests, and it's a brightly lit, almost cafeteria-looking kind of restaurant that specializes in all kinds of seafood, but in particular, a dozen different ways with shrimp. Everything from shrimp cocktails and a ceviche-style shrimp that's immersed in lime marinade to shrimps in Andiablos sauce, which is, lip-scorching hot.
Shrimp is really kind of one of the most popular dishes from the Chihuahua region of Mexico. And Tucson, you know, which is kind of an annex to Mexico, is probably the greatest place in the United States to eat authentic Mexican food. Marisco's Chihuahua is, as Michael said, just kind of a shrimp festival. That's the main thing you order there. And on the side, you just get very simple side dishes. And for beverages, you get an iced tea or a sweetened rice milk beverage. Is that horchata, Michael?
Horchata, yes.
Horchata, which is very, very nice with the shrimp.
What I love about the way they serve the shrimp is the presentation, because no matter what you get it sauced with, whether it's garlic butter, soy sauce, oyster sauce, or the Andiablos, it's set, all the shrimp, maybe a couple dozen shrimp, good medium-sized shrimp, are set on top of a layer of really crisp, delicious French fries. So that, you know, you eat the shrimp, and then you're left with these French fries that are still crispy, but kind of flavored by whatever the sauce on the shrimp was. So it's like a sort of a double dip into this flavor.
There's also something really festive about the way the shrimp are served. They come in enormous fish-shaped platters, and so with tortillas on the side. So it's kind of like a little bit of a starch festival, because you've got French fries and tortillas to sop your shrimp up with. But they have a wonderful Mexican garlic shrimp, which is kind of like a scampi, and that is so good when you dip the tortillas in them.
This sounds like it could put rice out of business. I mean, I never thought about this. French fries under your shrimp or anything else. It's a great idea.
It works so well because somehow the French fries stay crisp. You know, if they got all soggy underneath there, it wouldn't work. But by the time you get down to the French fries, they still have that nice crunch of a freshly made French fry, but with the addition of the great flavor of the shrimp. We should also add that the ambiance in this place is just so much fun, because on the sound system there is mariachi music playing constantly. On the wall is a gigantic mural of a very tempestuous sort of oceanscape. And to drink with this shrimp, in addition to the horchata and pre-sweetened iced tea, there is a wide variety of Mexican beers. So it's a lot of fun to go
and
there.
And it really is where the locals eat. We did not, except for ourselves, we did not see any out-of-towners there.
Is this the only restaurant?
I mean, there are three Marisco's Chihuahuas in Tucson, two in South Tucson, which is the real Mexican part of town, and is, in fact, a city unto itself, one in Tucson on 2902 East 22nd Street. That's the one where we ate two or three times when we were in Tucson.
So we go for shrimp,
in Tucson.
Okay.
Hey, thanks. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
It's.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Bye, Lynn.
Mexicano en el norte, no hace más que andar traqueado. Un mexicano en el norte, no hace más que andar traqueado. Porque el dinero no carga, mayormente si es mojado. Trayendo carro del año, envuelven al emigrado. Trayendo carro del año, envuelven al emigrado.
Shane and Michael Stern's newest book is the update of their great classic, Road Food. Now, every week you can hear them here on the Splendid Table, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to our website, splendidtable.org. Jenkins has been called the bad boy of the cheese world, the man who never holds back an opinion. But he's got the chops to back it up. Steve's one of the country's leading authorities. For 25 years, he's been ferreting out artisan-made cheeses all over the world. Steve is the author of Steve Jenkins' Cheese Primer. Steve, good to have you back.
Hi, Leah.
Steve, I need a primer in Chev.
Well, I'm the guy to give it to you.
Go for it. I want to understand this cheese called Chev.
Chev means nothing more than goat in French. You know, you could be talking about capra in Italian or cabra in Spanish. But when we use the word Chev, what we're referring to is fromage de Chev, meaning cheeses of goat's milk.
Okay.
And it's the easiest recipe to make cheese that there is in the entire pantheon of cheese making. Because all you're doing is ladling curd, that is goat's milk curd, into colanders, little colanders, meaning a receptacle with holes in it, so that the whey will drip out. And you're left behind with a specific shape that the colander gave to it. And then you've got fresh Chev. If you want to ripen it further, all you do is put it in the right room at the right temperature and humidity, and as the days and weeks go on, you have Chev that's got some maturity to it.
Steve, there are Chevs that are like cream cheese. There are Chevs that are like eating cheddar.
My goodness, yes, and there's so many different shapes, too. Understand that the more pristine and a Chev looks and the fresher that it appears to be and the softer that it is, that means that it's not aged. And that means that it's not going to have much flavor. So what you're doing is paying a lot of money for cream cheese, essentially. And that's not really the goat's milk cheese experience, as far as I'm concerned. You know, it's like people. Young people may not be as interesting as somebody that's as old as me, simply because I've had more experience and I've got more to talk about. Same thing goes with a cheese, and particularly a goat's cheese. So what I hope people will do is understand that goat cheese ought to be sort of middle-aged for it to be spectacular. That means it's going to have more of a beige exterior that's rougher. It may be spotted with blue mold, and all these things are perfectly fine in the way that it's supposed to be.
So name names for me.
Here we go. Well, you know, the best French chefs are certainly not Montrachet or Boucheron, both of which are factory goat cheeses, which means they're made from frozen curd and powdered milk and extruded from a machine like pasta. The best chefs are made by people, by hand, and most of these cheeses are named after the villages that they come from, like Valençay in the Loire Valley, which is a pyramidal-shaped chef with a flat top, or Pouligny-Saint-Pierre, which is also a pyramidal-shaped chef, though taller than Valençay. And there's St. Maur, M-A-U-R-E, from just south of Tours. That's the great log with a stick down the middle of it. There's also Crottin de Chavignol, Crottin referring to the shape of the cheese, Chavignol being the village. And then there's Chabichou, which is just a diminutive name for a goat's cheeses that are sort of tall, little barrel-shaped, meaning a sweet little goat, a Chabichou. And then there's some specific very small company names like Le Chevrot, Chevrot, that is utterly spectacular, as well as Pico, P-I-C-O. That's one of the great, great goat cheeses. This one from Quercy, from the Périgord region.
What about outside of France?
There are magnificent goat cheeses out of Spain now, and even more important, out of the United States. In Catalonia, there's a great goat cheese that's rich and sort of brie-like that's called Can Pujol. There's another one also from Catalonia that's called Garrocha. One from Asturias called Vare, V-A-R-E, that I adore. But then we've got the great Americans, Lynn. We've got the Humboldt Fog from Northern California. Humboldt Fog has that line of ash through the center, which when you pass a sharp knife through it to cut a wedge, the milk ash sort of fades through the cheese, and that's sort of fog-like, the way the fog is in Humboldt County right there on the coast. The Coach Farms here in New York State make fabulous goat cheeses. The Capriole Farm out in Indiana, Judy Shad, she makes Banon, she makes Wabash Cannonballs, she makes Mount St. Francis, she makes my old Kentucky Tom. Mm. I want our listeners to know how many great American chefs there are available out there, and to stop opting for those thick cryovac logs and buttons of French stuff that's not worthy of them.
Well, Steve, you did it again. Thank you for the primer.
A pleasure.
Steve Jenkins is author of Steve Jenkins Cheese Primer. Now, you can find Steve behind the cheese counter at Fairway Markets in New York City. You can find his goat cheese picks on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, take a look at the Splendid Table store. Now, if you'd like to check out some of my personal cheese picks, click your way through to the American Cheese Passport. It's a collection of artisan cheeses, including the first cheese to prove America could produce something equal to France or Italy. It's Vella Dry Jack from California. And the story is that the Vella family, Italians to the core, developed this hard cheese during World War II because they couldn't get Parmigiano Reggiano from Italy. So it's easy to find on the site, splendidtable.org. Coming up, it's vegetables with the expert's expert, Elizabeth Schneider, learning Mexican mole in Oaxaca, and open lines for your calls. That number is 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. A book arrived recently that I think is a must-have for anybody with a serious interest in food. It's called Vegetables, From Amaranth to Zucchini, The Essential Reference. Now, the subtitle isn't an oversell. This is really a collection of vegetable biographies. If you want to know what it is, how to buy it, and how to cook it, the book tells you. Its author and our guest is Elizabeth Schneider, a woman who's been researching and writing about vegetables for over a decade. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you kindly.
How did you decide what went into this book?
In fact, I chose only vegetables about which I felt quite sure I could make some discovery. That is, if I couldn't contribute something fresh to a culinary perspective or give accessibility to something unusual, I just plain didn't include it in the book. And I would go to a number of markets and select samples throughout the year to be sure that I had a representative of each of the vegetables that was being profiled. And then I went through a process of cooking them in their most elemental ways. That is, I boiled them, steamed them, fried them, roasted them, sautéed them, ignoring tradition, what I had learned previously, so that I could discover which techniques best exemplified really the heart and soul of each vegetable. And then I develop a recipe using those techniques. So if there isn't a recipe for fried eggplant, it's because I felt it was better broiled and steamed. Hmm. And that was basically the way I went about developing the recipes.
Mm-hmm. The beet section really got to me. Tell me about beets.
I would love to tell you all about beets because they've moved up in society lately. They are no longer the lowly creatures that they were and have become very much a part of high-end restaurants, and you see them much more often. I think that's in part because there are new varieties in the marketplace. New is not really true. They're not designer veggies. They're old varieties that are reappearing. And because of better transport and because of more interest in vegetables, you're seeing them in better form. You're seeing them with their greens, which are so much a wonderful part of beets and have been neglected. I didn't cook them in traditional ways, and I've discovered a few treatments for beets, and they show different aspects of the beet.
Mm-hmm.
And my very favorite of all is a very long, slow cook that is in a moderate oven. You wrap each beet in foil, and you scent it with whatever suits you. The aromas I fancy are a bit of cinnamon, a piece of star anise, or I stick a clove into each beet, or tuck in a few fennel seeds into each packet, and then just close up the packet and set as many beets as I want in the pan, and cook them until they're done. Until they're done simply means you stick the point of a knife into mm-hmm. them, right into the packet, and you'll see that they're done. You take them out, you leave them as long as it's convenient, and then the nice thing about this is that there's not quite as much mess as there is with other beets because they're in those little packets, and you just rub the packets with your hands and squish them about and then slip the beet out. And what happens is that you've taken off the skin and the beet has been scented with those spices, and you have the whole clean beet ready to either slice up and warm up in a little butter or to let cool and toss with a little fruit vinegar or balsamic. And I like to just put them onto the nest them on the steamed leaves, which are very much at their best steamed.
Mm-hmm.
I've tried them braised, I've tried them boiled, I've tried them sautéed, but the softness and the delicacy of the leaves comes out best, I find, when you simply steam them.
There's something else that you see in the market a lot that I think a lot of us ignore, or we just use it as a seasoning, the leek.
Well, leeks are a little bit scary, I think, to some people because they're so giant. I mean, they look formidable, but in fact, they are among the most delicate of the allium group, and they need a good deal of cooking. But once they're cooked, they become very sweet, mild, more complex than the other oniony vegetables, gentler, which is why they can be featured as a primary subject, that is, rather than simply as a seasoning.
Mm-hmm.
And my favorite way of cooking them is maintaining their very sweet nature and adding very little else. You're going to begin to think I do nothing but cook in packets because this is another another recipe that is cooked in foil. There may only be three or four in the book, but these are the two that spring to mind.
Uh-huh.
Leeks can have a few raggedy greens, but the thing to beware of is woodiness in the stem itself. That is, the white part of the leek you should examine quite carefully. The size is really not important. They're going to be tender when they cook up, whether they're quite small or gigantic. I mean, they can be 3 or 4 inches in diameter, and they're much larger in Europe, in fact, than what we have here. But you look at that white part, and it should be straight. It should have no bulge marking it like an onion. And give it a bend and make sure that it's elastic, that there is a real give in it, because otherwise you'll find that it may very well have that woody core which will not cook away no matter how much time you spend in the oven.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that leeks need is real serious cleaning because, of course, that mud or sand hides in between the interstices. And you can, if you're going to cook the leeks whole, you do indeed need to slit it from base to tip, right straight through, and slosh it very, very seriously in a couple of water baths.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're not cooking it whole, there's no reason to go through all that. You can simply cut off the root and slice it. And most of those greens are good. You really, even if they're quite heavy, you can keep them. And I think I was going to tell you about my favorite way of maintaining its flavor and texture, which is that herbed packet with carrots. Cut the leek into, just manageable 1-inch sections or so. Do the same thing to a carrot. And then season it with minced mushrooms and whatever herbs. You need the moisture from the mushrooms, and it's a nice thing to add instead of liquid.
Mm-hmm.
And a little tiny bit of a touch of sugar, touch of salt. And I like thyme, and I like marjoram in there, either one. And spread that on the leek and on the carrot. Close it up like a turnover, and just give it a bake for about 20 minutes. And you can do that while you're letting a roast rest, or you can do it's deceptively simple. That is, the whole quality of leeks comes through with that sweetness of the carrot and the slight bit of herbal addition.
Well, I'm going to be baking leeks, and I'm going to be baking beets this weekend. Thank you, Elizabeth.
You're welcome.
Elizabeth Schneider is author of The Essential Reference, Vegetables from Amaranth to Zucchini. Well, she left us with her recipe for baked scented beets and greens. Find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Graham of Bonnie Doone Vineyard is the original Rhone Ranger, the leader of a band of young California vintners who are making wine with grapes from France's Rhone River Valley, instead of the more usual Cabernet or Chardonnay. Randall makes other kinds of wines, too. In fact, new wines, at least for California. Wine lovers are taking Bonnie Doone wines pretty seriously. Randall, on the other hand, says his mission statement is, and I quote, having as much fun with wine as the relevant government agencies will allow. Randall, welcome back to the Splendid Table.
Thank you very much.
I have to know something. Why are there pink plastic corks in your wine?
Excellent question. Well, there are pink plastic corks in our wine because I grew terribly disillusioned with natural corks. I mean, I'm a bleeding heart environmentalist, of course, and I love the idea of natural corks and things that are recyclable and renewable. However, corks that you can buy these days are absolutely terrible, and there's a big problem with corkiness, which is to say cork taint in wines. It's absolutely ubiquitous.
Really? What's happened to the cork?
There are different theories, I mean, different conspiracy theories about what's happened to corks. But basically, I think it's a matter of too much demand and not enough supply. And the cork oaks are not old enough. For whatever reason, there's a very high incidence of bacterial contamination of the corks. And some people estimate that it's as much as 6 to 10% of the corks of the wines that you buy are affected, albeit at a very low level, with some sort of cork taint.
But isn't there a role that cork plays, that plastic, rubber, whatever, can't? I mean, isn't it supposed to expand and absorb moisture and do all the other kinds of things?
It does all of those things, and it's actually a brilliant closure. But it's basically a wonderful closure for the Middle Ages. But for the 21st century, I think we could probably do a little bit better.
Well, if you had your druthers, then would you be using your pink plastic corks, or is there some other solution to this thing?
Well, I like the pink plastic corks in the sense that they actually make a very good closure, and they give us another design element for our packaging. However, I would say they're also imperfect. The real wave of the future, I think, is screw caps.
What?
Screw caps. You heard me right.
Wait a minute. No, screw caps is what you put on wines that cost very little money.
And you drink it by the railroad tracks.
You want to see fine wines in with screw caps.
Absolutely.
Why?
Absolutely. Screw cap is a brilliant, brilliant closure. It makes a more perfect seal than a cork. Actually, there's a misconception that people have that wines continue to need to breathe or need oxygen after they're bottled. In fact, the definition of when a wine is ready to bottle is when it needs no more oxygen.
So this screw top really seals it better than a cork.
It makes
would.
A better seal. And the other thing is that if you think about the analogy of a wine bottle, a Magnum will age more gracefully than a 750 and a double Magnum more gracefully than a Magnum. So therefore, a screw cap, which makes a better closure, will actually age more gracefully and give you a more complex wine at the end.
Okay, so a Magnum is the equivalent of two normal bottles, and when the 750 is the normal bottle.
Correct.
And then when I drink only half a bottle, I can screw the top on more easily than jam the cork back in. This is going to take some mulling.
It's a leap of faith. But the people who are really, really into it, which are the wine writers, the sommeliers, the people who really know wine, are absolutely up in arms about corks. They just are so unhappy with the incidence of corked wines. It's just going to take a while for the consumers to really get the message.
So, Randall, are you going to be the pioneer? I mean, are you going to do this with your wines?
I've done crazier things before. Yes, absolutely. We're going to release our Big House Red and Big House White en screw cap July 1st. And if the winery is still standing a month or two later, we're going to probably consider taking the rest of the brand to screw cap as well.
Well, you heard it here first, folks. Randall, thank you.
My pleasure.
Winemaker Randall Graham is creator of Bonnie Dune Vineyards. What does a chef do when she's burnt out and fed up? In the case of Susanna Trilling, she takes off to Mexico for a short escape. 15 years later, she is still there, due in a large part to a friendship with an older Mexican cook named Carlota.
Susanna Trilling's rancho is nestled in a valley near the small Mexican town of San Lorenzo Cuauhtepec in Oaxaca State in southern Mexico. From her kitchen window, Susanna can see the ruins of the great archaeological site at Mitla. Inside, at a big wooden table in the kitchen, Susanna and Carlota sit preparing chilies for a mole, the first dish Carlota taught Susanna. This is a coloradito mole, one of those wonderful spicy chocolatey sauces usually served with chicken. It's a complicated dish, taking hours to prepare, and includes chiles, tomatoes, nuts, raisins, and spices like cinnamon and clove, and of course, the acclaimed Mexican chocolate made from cacao and sugar. Susanna and Carlota start by taking the stems off the chili anchos, which are about 4 inches wide with a rich, thick skin. Susanna remembers the first time she made a coloradito mole and presented it to Carlota.
So out of like 25 ingredients, she knew what ingredients I had left out. Out of all these different ingredients, she took one little taste and said, "You left this out," and she was right. So then I was like completely blown away by that.
The connection between these women started with a man, Eric Ulrich, now Susanna's husband. But when they met, Eric was a regular customer at Carlota's little fonda, or home restaurant, in the town nearby.
So I came to her door and I knocked on her door and I said, "Can you tell me where the house of Eric is?" And she said, "Pásale, ven, ven." And so she sat me down and she says, "Do you want some atole?" And I said, "Okay." I mean, I didn't hardly understand a word, right? And she said, "Oh, mucho mujeres." She said, "Eric has so many women." And she talked to me for like an hour straight all about Eric and all his things, and I didn't understand one word. So then she started to like me, so she taught me all the dishes that he liked to eat so that I could make him happy. So that's her story of why she taught me the food, all because of Eric. ¿Qué quieres, Carlota? ¿Un sotén, like así?
No, yeah.
Okay. I mean, I was always doing whatever she told me, like a slave. Sometimes in the beginning, she would only let me stir.
Over time, Susanna learned what it is that makes Oaxacan cooking special.
For me, it's first of all, the freshness of the ingredients, the ripeness of the ingredients. Then it's the techniques, and that like they're really used over and over and over, the time-honored techniques. All the ingredients are toasted, roasted, and fried, like you see. Everything is brought into their essential flavors.
But while the techniques may be time-honored, on this day, Susanna is surprised by the changes Carlota is making.
¿Quieres?
Sí, mira.
¿Me pone aquí después, no? ¿O es almendra?
No,
es
aparte.
¿Y este?
Ese va el último.
¿Pero solo?
Solo.
Ay, she taught me something different, too. That's really funny. She's told me to start with the sesame seed, and then you add some nuts to it. Almonds. And then now she's saying, no, we have to do it separately. And she's also added peanuts that she's never put in before. I know, it's like, it's great, it's evolved.
Carlota stirs the mole with an unbelievably enormous wooden spoon, the handle alone nearly 3 feet long. The mole bubbles in a huge clay olla, or bowl-shaped pot. Carlota's barely tall enough to peer into the pot and take a taste.
Hey, Carlota, ¿qué piensa?
¿Qué piensas de mole?
Está rico. Como lo hice yo, está rico.
Ah! Because she made it, it's so good. Oh. Mmm, está riquísimo. It's like más sazón que hacemos aquí. But this mole is different from what we make. It has a more seasoning in it. Está mejorando con la caldo. Oh!
Both women are pleased. Being together means family, community, which Susanna Trilling says she feels throughout Mexico. She talked about that one day as she sat under a tree beside the church of San Antonino Ocotlan, an agricultural village nearby.
There's a lot of time with families together. So you'll have the mother, the daughter-in-law, and her kids swinging in a little, you know, hammock or something, the little baby. But they're all there together in the kitchen. Yeah, there's really a feeling here. There's like this spirit here. I think that's what the thing that's kept me here the longest is the emotion, I think, more than anything. Not so much like I've learned dishes, but I've learned cariño or caring, you know?
An essential ingredient in any kitchen.
Mary Stuckey is a freelance reporter living in St. Paul. Susanna Trilling is author of Seasons of My Heart. She lives in the state of Oaxaca and runs a cooking school there. You can get the recipe for Oaxacan coloradito mole on our website, splendidtable.org. Okay, it's time for the weekly food challenge. This week's question is, what is at least 50 years old by the time you eat it and a common entree on budget menus? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I got the answer to this week's trivia query. Now, the question was, what is at least 50 years old by the time you eat it and a common entree on budget menus? Well, it's a fish. It's orange roughy. Now, orange roughy, which comes from New Zealand and Australia, suddenly took off in the 1980s. It's one of those fish that can take a lot of abuse. You can overcook it, you can reheat it. So eateries with cooks who may not be the most skillful on earth love it. And it's cheap. Now, the problem is that by the early 1990s, orange roughy was almost fished out. Part of the reason is it takes an orange roughy 50 to 80 years to grow to market size, and that's only 5 pounds, which is why conservationists don't want us to eat them. Jennifer Dianto from the Seafood Watch program at the Monterey Bay Aquarium sums up the whole idea with one sentence. Never eat a fish that can grow older than you can.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can't be so warm and tender. Call me. Don't be afraid.
We're opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to it. We've got Jay on the line. So, Jay, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. How are you today?
I am fine. What's on your mind?
I had a question about huitlacoche, which is corn smut.
It always sounds like you're talking about a stripper's, hangout. Corn smut. Yes. So the Mexican name for it is huitlacoche, right?
Yes, yes.
Okay, but what's the question?
My question is, when I'm in Mexico, I always enjoy having it. And it's normally served in a very rustic manner, in enchiladas or, with the salsa.
Right.
And my question really is, how could you prepare that in a more elegant manner? And secondly, where can you locate it in the States?
Ooh, I think for everyone who's wondering what in heaven's name we're talking about, and this isn't going to sound attractive, guys, but it tastes sweet and earthy at the same time. Evidently, when corn is grown in a very humid environment, i.e. like Mexico, it can develop, essentially, it's a growth. It's like a mold, and it's called huitlacoche. Now, there's another translation of that rather than corn smut. It's corn truffle, and I think that's a good marketing term.
Mm-hmm.
One way I know that it's handled is that it is sautéed with garlic and chilies, and sometimes in butter, which is interesting because you don't see a lot of butter used in Mexico, and something like a serrano chili, and then it's mixed with sweet corn.
Okay.
Which would, I think, be really interesting as
right,
a combination.
Right.
Ron Bechtol is an architect and a food writer down in San Antonio, and he made a fabulous Mexican dinner for me at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a dish where, if I remember correctly, he put the corn truffle in the sauce. The memory is vague, but this is what I recall. It was butter. It was garlic. I think it was something like ancho chilies, which are velvety and have a sweet undertone.
Right.
Which would work with the earthiness and the loveliness of the corn truffle. And I think it had walnuts in it.
Okay.
And he served that. I want to say it then was blended with sautéed chicken breast.
Okay.
It was rather elegant. It was not a rustic dish at all.
Okay.
So does that help you?
It helps quite a bit. And would epazote work well with that?
Yeah, you mean the fresh herb?
Yeah.
Sure. So does fresh coriander if you can't get the fresh epazote.
Okay, great, Lynn. Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Nothing like a little esoterica. Corn truffle, much better term than corn smut. But, this comes back to that idea of how many different cultures eat different things that we might turn our noses up at. And it reminds me of something I ran into at one point. I came across a study that was done about how different parts of the world view other parts of the world. And it was very interesting that in North Africa, the people of North Africa viewed those of us who eat with a knife and fork with great disdain, and they were very suspect because their theory was, how could you know how that was washed? Whereas when you eat with your hand, you know exactly how it was cared for, and you have complete control over it. The other thing that was observed by the Japanese was that our houses are designed that the area, the plumbing that carries the waste, is also attached to the same part of the plumbing that brings fresh water, and it would evidently not exist in a Japanese home. Kind of interesting. It's all your point of view. Corn truffle. What do you do when corn has a mold on it? You make a delicacy out of it. Okay, enough. You can reach us, 800-537-5252. Okay, who has been waiting patiently? We've got Melinda. Hey, Melinda, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, actually, what I'd like to talk about is fiddlehead ferns.
Oh, God. Can you get your hands on them?
Oh, yeah. This time of year, I live right next to a river, and we have lots of fiddlehead ferns come up, and my boyfriend and I go pick them, and we love them. But the only way we've really found that we like them a lot is to put them in egg, bread them, and fry them.
That sounds pretty swell, Melinda. I mean, I don't know if I'd want to give up on that.
Well, I'm sure we won't, but I'd like to have some other ways of doing it, if you have any ideas.
Well, one thing, just to explain what they are, fiddlehead ferns are ferns that are just coming out of the ground, and they haven't uncurled yet, so they look like the top of a violin. They're all curled up against one another, right?
Right.
And they're delicate. Describe the taste.
Oh.
Hate to put you on the spot, but...
Yeah, well, they have their own unusual flavor, and I don't know as I could describe it.
They've always kind of reminded me of sweet peas mixed with scallions. You know, I mean, that kind of...
Yeah, that might be a good description.
Okay, but you want some ideas for other than frying them. Sauté in butter. You know, when in doubt with something delicate and spring-like and green, sauté them in butter, maybe with a little bit of diced shallot or a tad of garlic. Keep it as simple as possible because you really want to taste.
Yeah, they have such a bold flavor of their own. It's
right.
Hard to mix them with anything.
That's right, exactly. I mean, the one thing I like with them, though, is if you sauté them in a bit of butter, then what you do is when you serve them, toast up whole blanched almonds and just crack them. You know, you want big chunks of almonds. And a little garlic in that saute, and then just sprinkle them with those chunks of toasted almonds. They taste like nothing on earth. See, try it. See what you think. I mean, that's sort of the pure Zen experience of a fiddlehead fern.
Well, I'm into the Zen experience with that, believe me.
Well, where do you live that you got them growing right down by the river?
I live in upstate New York, right off of Lake Ontario.
I'd have to go down to the curb and hope they'd show up. Okay. Hey, Melinda, thank you.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
You know, the big question here is, if you don't go foraging for them, if you don't have them nearby the way Melinda does, is it worth spending the money on fiddlehead ferns in the market? Because you can see them in some fancy food stores. And I've seen them as high as $20 a pound. Well, the answer is, check out how they look, because when a fiddlehead fern is no longer fresh and unhappy, it turns kind of dark, it gets kind of slimy. What this should look like, it should look bright green and crisp and as though it's just been cut. Then if you feel like splurging, it's worth it. Oh, and use them right away. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We have Brennan on the line. So Brennan, what do you want to talk about?
Vidalia onions.
Ah, okay. What about Vidalia onions?
Well, I know that they are, you know, the most wonderful onions in the world. Any time that you're using them raw on a burger or something like that, they're fantastic.
Right.
But I've heard contradictory claims about whether or not you're really getting the advantage of them by cooking them, and I'm hoping that you can clear this up.
Well, this is still a matter of opinion.
Okay.
And there will probably be people who will hear this who will disagree. But I think there is nothing more boring than a cooked sweet onion like a Vidalia or a Maui or a Walla Walla. Because they just, I don't know, they don't have any guts when you cook them. But when you keep them raw, that sweetness is there, the flavor is there. Because it's not just that they're mild, they taste good. And I think when you really go to saute them, they just go blah, you know? I mean, it's boring.
Okay, I can understand that. I've heard some people claim that because it's higher in sugar, it caramelizes the sugar and brings out more of the sweetness.
I think you know, if you want to caramelize onions, use a regular good old yellow or a white one or a red one, and get that heat pretty high.
And so save the good Vidalias for the raw application.
Right. And you know, one way you can make strong onions very sweet is they're two extremes, either very high heat or cook them real slow. They turn to sugar. But I think the glory of these sweet onions is in the raw and in salads and in dishes. I mean, the other night we've just started to see Vidalias in our markets, and I took lime juice and Vidalia, and I had a Thai roast chicken. I put a ton of chilies under the skin, and we mixed that all together with some fish sauce. And when my husband said, I can't eat this because it's too hot, he added mayonnaise. And although it has nothing to do with Thailand, with those Vidalia onions, it was killer. It was the best chicken salad I'd ever eaten. So let them shine, you know, as themselves.
Okay, that sounds great. I'm hoping they'll start showing up in the stores around here pretty soon.
And by the way, there's also Maui and there's also Walla Walla's. So you got the whole you know, deal coming in at different times during the year.
All right, well, thank you.
Hey, you're welcome, Brennan. Thank you.
All right, bye.
There is this moment, you know, every year where we get asparagus in the best condition it's ever going to be in. And we get scallions in their prime. This is called the spring. I have a dish I love to do, and it's the easiest way in the world. And nobody ever thinks of doing this with scallions, because scallions are a great vegetable. All you do is you take really fresh scallions, you trim off the root, you trim off the very, very, very top of the green part, but leave all of it intact. Take the thinnest asparagus you can. And what you do is just sprinkle them with a little olive oil and salt and pepper. And a sprinkle of sugar, very little. Then take a griddle or your barbecue. Get the fire hot and grill them. And they're going to turn. You want high heat. You don't want them to turn to mush. You want to be able to pierce them and still have a little resistance. But what's going to happen is they're going to get golden brown and they're kind of crusty and almost black on the outside in some places. And you just put those on a plate and you sprinkle them with balsamic vinegar. And this is heaven. So try grilled asparagus and grilled scallions. And remember, scallions are a vegetable. It's amazing the kind of research going on in our universities these days. For instance, at Monmouth University in New Jersey, Professor David Strometz is testing the power of sweets to boost tips in restaurants. Now, we have the professor on the phone to learn more about this. David Strometz, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Lynn.
Now, can you explain the study that you've done?
Well, one of the things that a colleague of mine and myself, Bruce Rind of Temple University, we're interested in what tactics do waiters and waitresses use to supplement your income? We're always observing behavior. And one of the things we've observed that waitresses and waiters do is give their customers candy. And the question is, why? Why would they do that, and what impact does it have on tips? So what we did in our particular study is we simply kept track of tips when the waiter, or actually it was the waitress, gave a piece of candy to the customers when delivering the check or didn't give. And what we found was, sure enough, tips went up, just giving this little piece of candy. Now, the question is, why? Why would that make a difference? And we did a follow-up study trying to look at this. Because what we've known is that people make tipping decisions based on a lot of things other than the quality of the service. Very social reasons. For example, if people are in a good mood, they tend to evaluate the service better and therefore give better tips. Or sometimes people feel like they're obligated to give something back to the server if the server did something unexpected. So what we did in this particular study is we had the server come to the table with a basket of chocolates. And in one condition, she gave everyone a piece of chocolate. She said, here, take a piece of chocolate. And sure enough, her tips went up about 2%. But then it's like, well, is it the power of chocolate or is it the power of feeling like the waitress gave me a little treat? So what we did is we had the waitress this time give everyone two pieces of chocolate, seeing like, well, if I give you more, will you feel like you have to tip me more? And sure enough, it went up. But the third condition I find the most interesting, what we did is we had the waitress go and offer everyone a piece of candy. And then just as she's leaving the table, she said, oh, have another piece. And it was in this condition that the candy had the most powerful effect. It actually raised tips about 4 to 5% over doing nothing. So what this suggests to us is that just by doing something extra, people feel obligated to reciprocate. And that's a very powerful norm we have in society. This idea of, if someone does something unexpected for me, I feel like I need to reciprocate, give back. And certainly, this is something that servers could use to help supplement their income.
Well, it sounds like that old adage, you get more with honey than you do with vinegar.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's fascinating because, really, tips should be based on quality of service. And it's obvious that the whole enterprise of tipping is as much a psychological phenomenon as well as economic phenomenon.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Strometz.
Thank you very much.
That was Professor David Strometz from Monmouth University in New Jersey. His study was reported in the Journal of Applied Social Psychology. Well, that's it for this week. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. So, until next week, let me leave you with this from Steve Wright. I went to a restaurant that advertised it serves breakfast at any time, so I ordered French toast during the Renaissance. If you want information on anything you heard on today's show, you can reach us by sending a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's The Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. The other alternative is take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. And check out the Splendid Table store while you're at it. You're going to find foods that I've taste tested myself, and all the proceeds go to support the show. Our program is produced by Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Lupke and Jennifer Russell. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.